Hey there, welcome to episode 67 of Audacious Food Talk for Gluttons. This is Janae Libby. Today's show is sponsored by Teej.fm, T-E-E-J.fm. It's a brand new collaborative community podcast network created by WTJU right here in Charlottesville, Virginia. WTJU is celebrating their 60th year on the air. Not six, not 16, 60 years on the air. Congratulations, WTJU, Teej.fm for more information. Also want to thank my Patreon sponsors. If you know about Patreon, you know they are a wonderful service who help artists and small entrepreneurs build their business, keep their business solvent. I have sponsors at patreon.com/audaciouspod. Click on that link to learn more. Can't wait to get started. 4 out of 4 in the podcast series, Virginia Festival of the Book. Here we go, guys. Welcome! Welcome to the 4th podcast in a series of 4. I have never done this before. If you listen to Audacious, you know that I have a long-form interview podcast that comes out every other Thursday. So to do 4 podcasts in 4 days has been quite the undertaking. I think I'm going to get it done. I think it's going to happen. The first one went up yesterday. I'm actually recording this on Friday. This is the episode that will air on Sunday, and I have a feeling by the end of the day, I will not even know what day it is, but I am excited to be doing this, excited to be a community partner with this project, with the Virginia Festival of the Book. Why am I doing this? For connection, to bring our community together. I want to expand the concept of food, to focus on the people doing the work of food, to get the focus off of the finished plate and into our kitchens, fields, stores, boardrooms, and to our desks and computers, to the writers doing the work of food. That is the focus this week on food writing. And today's interview fits right in with that. Jason Tesoro, he wrote a book called The Modern Gentleman. I just bought a copy for my nephew who will be graduating in June from high school. I think he could use a copy. He is the sommelier and has been for quite a while out at Barbersville Vineyards. And his piece on Chef Bo Beck made the Best American Food Writing 2016. And Jason will be appearing with 3 other excellent food authors who all made it into the Best American Food Writing series this Sunday. What day is this? All right, I'm posting this on Sunday the 19th. So on Sunday the 26th, I told you I would mess up my days. On Sunday, March 26th, from 1 to 2:30 at JMRL on Market Street, the Best American Food Writing Panel will happen. Editor Holly Hughes will be there. I will be there with books to sign because I am fans of all of these guys and I want all of them to sign my books. And we will talk about food writing. Why is that important? Why are we having this panel? Because food writing is valid. Food writing is important. Food writing deserves more shelf space in our Barnes & Nobles and in our New Dominion bookshops and in our local bookstores, Chop Suey Books, Black Swan Books. I'm thinking of all the lovely local bookstores that I used to visit when I grew up in Richmond. And I interviewed Jason in Richmond, in Jackson Ward. That was incredibly nostalgic for me, walking around, walked right past Guar Bar, the milk building, the milk bottle building. I used to live in the area, spent my formative, sometimes alcohol-sodden years in that area. I had a lot of adventures in that area, and so it was a thrill to speak with Jason in Richmond, in my old stomping grounds, and to talk with him about one of my favorite topics, food writing. Before we get to the interview, there are a few announcements, as always. I was privileged and honored to appear on the radio last Saturday. To Your Health is a wonderful show on WPVC 94.7. MC Blair is its lovely and talented host. It airs every Saturday from 11 a.m. to noon. I was on the show last weekend to talk about the book festival. I will have a link to the audio in the show notes. I want to wish Mr. Blair a happy birthday. He just had a birthday yesterday, and it was kind of a big one. He made me feel welcome. He made me feel at home, and it was a thrill to be on the other side of the microphone for once. We had a rollicking good time. Check it out. I've got the link in the show notes. I also want to give a shout out to Elizabeth Raymond of No Bull Burger. I am taking a 16-week class as part of the Community Investment Collaborative. We meet at City Space every Tuesday night for 3 hours. Whew, it's a long haul. We are learning to build our business. I would like to make Audacious a viable, solvent business that grows with every passing year, and this is why I'm taking the class. Elizabeth and her mother, Chris Ann, were guests of mine early on in the podcast, and I'm thrilled to say that she is in my work group. We are throwing ideas off each other every week, building our businesses together. So just wanted to give No Bull Burger a quick shout out. If you're a vegetarian, even if you're not, it's a great product, guys. Shall we get to the interview? Let's. Quick shout out to the sponsors, Teej.fm. Thank you for making me a part of your community collaborative podcast network. And thank you to my patrons, to my sponsors at Patreon.com. Check out Patreon.com/AudaciousPod for more information. Jason Tesoro, did you set your intention this morning? When you woke up, did you take a deep breath and go, okay, today I'm going to be happy, live in gratitude, and produce a podcast episode. And that is my intention. We talk about that in this interview. It's one of the great ones, guys, because we go off topic. We start on food, but as always with these conversations, food is only a beginning point. It's only a touchstone for many other deeper life questions. And if I had to pick a theme for today's conversation, it is definitely setting your intention and being self-aware and living your life awake. I love the talk. Hope you do too. See you in a bit. Thank you so much for talking with me. I was very eager to speak with you because we know a lot of the same people.
Yes, we have a zillion mutual friends. How have we not crossed paths?
Well, my cousin's married to Ed Trask, so yeah.
Come on,
Kelly is my cousin.
Kelly and Amy Lee are like soul sisters, and Eleanor and my eldest boy Sebastian were like crushing on each other. They're both tall blondes.
Yeah. Ooh. My Eleanor's our oldest niece, like on that side of the family.
She's
my shining star.
I love her.
I'm putting all my hopes and dreams under this girl.
Hey, don't leave out Loudon.
Oh, Loudon, and he's awesome too. I've got two nephews of my own, or my sister's son. So like Eleanor, I don't have any kids of my own, so I kind of like look at Eleanor's Instagram and go nuts.
She's so talented. I mean, look at the raw materials.
Right. Yeah. I know. Coolest wedding ever. Went to their wedding. I remember when she met him.
They were teenagers, right?
Yeah. Long time. But I always driving to Richmond, my thing is I always try and figure out how to start the interview because that can be awkward for me. But you help so much. I was reading an article yesterday, totally unrelated to this interview. Jason Tesoro remarked, and I went, oh, so I want to read this quote.
Sure.
It's about food writing. It was in The Ringer, Brian Curtis, editor.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And it was The Rise and Fall of Food Writing.
Yeah.
And it relates to kind of what we're going to talk about. I feel like people are longing for connection, said the writer Jason Tesoro. We've gotten to a place where soul and authenticity and genuineness, there's a dearth of it about. A lot of food writing just deals with surface. It's restaurant reviews and hype, and look at what I found that you haven't heard about yet. But peel that back, and what you're really getting is an excuse to write about what's real. Mm. And so my first question is, why is food writing important?
Why is food writing important? Well, there's why it's important to me and why I think it's important at this time. And there's a place where they overlap. Let's talk about that.
Yeah.
I think it's important now and important to me because we need that anchor as we get further and further away from truth in so many ways.
Yeah.
There's something really honest about farmer picks, cook, takes, puts on plate. And then the job of the writer, to me, like a great chef, is simply to express what's been given to them. Mm-hmm. And my job as a writer, I want you to see past my words into the intention of that grower, of that chef, of that restaurateur. And earlier in my career, I wanted you to go, look at me, look at my fancy vocabulary.
Yeah.
And as I've matured as a writer, I've matured as an eater, because the chefs and restaurants that I admire most are the ones who have the bravado to keep it simple. There's a chef in Atlanta, Linton Hopkins, his restaurant, Eugene, one of the finest restaurants in America, James Beard Award winner. You go to his tasting menu, and one time a dish was just called Eat This Plum. And people were flummoxed. They're like, well, do I cut it? What do I do? Is it a surprise? Like, well, do I need a fork? Like, pick it up and eat the plum.
Yeah.
And the courage it took, because the plum was perfect. It was the perfect expression of summer. So sometimes my sentences, you'd be like, what do we need to sorrow for? My job may be simply to find the right adjective and verb, put them in an order that allows you to see what I saw and not just see my fancy liberal arts degree.
Exactly. And you mentioned like being simple in your piece that was in the Best American Food Writing. Is it Bo Beck?
Mm-hmm.
He described himself as a complicated simple.
He is a complicated simple. He'll take, and I think that's why he and I gravitated toward each other. And I'm not Hemingway. When I say I keep things simple, there's still a lot of wordplay and a lot of onomatopoetics, the musicality of language.
Sure.
And Bo will take that beautiful raw ingredient, an avocado, but the complicated part becomes how he transforms it for a plate while preserving the essence of that avocado. He may not manipulate or cook, apply fire or technique, but what he'll do is cut them and create something symmetrical on the plate that changes the way you look at the avocado. He may present the avocado in the shape of another vegetable. And so it plays with your perception.
Right.
And part of my job is not simply to report the food news, right? But I want to help enlighten, enliven. And that means the complicated simple is, what if you don't know anything about caviar? Some people will simply say, well, I was tasting the beluga, which was $94 a gram. And instead, I want to invite you into the discovery and never be afraid to say, I didn't know. I learned ...
Right.
And that's the complicated part is, how do I put my ego aside and how can I explore the humanity when really the story is about like a bunch of grapes?
Sure.
It's about a beet, but it's not really the beet. It's the heartbeat of the grower who survived the winter and made the ground sing.
Yeah. Again, a lot like food writing, because it's never just about the food. There's always so many other themes, deeper themes.
Yeah, that's the complicated part.
That's the complicated part. Mm-hmm. Is it like modernist cuisine? Does he manipulate the ingredient with like smoke and mirrors and guar gum and all that other mess? Or is it... Because I haven't eaten his food. I'm curious.
He's a Michelin star chef in Denmark, and he was doing things like Noma did until recently, just closed. Before Noma really became Noma.
Okay.
He was doing El Bulli when Ferran Adrià was doing it in Spain. So he's from that movement.
Yeah.
But the way that he landed his first restaurant was he took a camp stove the day that he had to line up the funding for this restaurant. And he cooked a leek for the bank president and brought it in and said, eat this. This is what I want to do. And the bank manager laughed.
It was just a leak.
And said, I will personally co-sign this.
That's so cool. So it's forgive the term, it seems less precious than something.
Absolutely. He is not what I call a tweezer
Alania.
Punk.
Oh, a tweezer punk. I like that.
Tweezer punks. These are the cats that, you know, they get the fancy butcher tattoos, yeah, but they don't know how to properly chiffonade basil. Right. You know, I say this knowing full well that I can't do either one. I have no tattoos, and I don't know if I could properly chiffonade, but I'm just learned enough to be around those chefs who say, pay attention. When someone is showing you their technique and showing you their ego, that can be a cover-up for a lack of respect or a lack of
Absolutely.
Knowledge. And I would rather hire someone off the street mm-hmm. who's kind and hardworking and has zero food knowledge mm-hmm. than someone who thinks they know it all and they're in their 20s. Because here I am in my 45s, and yeah. I still only know this much. I'm holding my thumb and forefinger.
Yeah, same, me too. Me too. I'm always learning stuff. What I'm hearing, like, he takes an ingredient and kind of stretches it to its limits.
Well, it pushes our understanding
of it. Nice.
That's something that
nice.
I love about Bobek's food. He will take two ingredients that we're familiar with and put them on a plate in a mashup that we've never experienced. And as a poet, the juxtaposition... I did a rhyme recently. I was doing a spoken word piece, and I rhymed botrytis with invitus, right? I was like talking about Psalms, like, hey, you know, like those cats who don't know the difference between Pinot and Port,
yeah.
Like, you know, you've got your wines botrytis, this is the noble rot. Master sommelier Robert Jones, invite us, you know, to help train you. So taking words, I don't know if in the history of the English language those words have ever been rhymed before. I'd love to read that poem. And I didn't do it just because I want to take two words that hadn't rhymed. It was
sure.
fun to create a discovery.
Sure.
And I think Bo never plays it safe.
Yeah.
And I'm drawn to artists who live in that space. You know, mm-hmm. Pete Wells took down Keller at Per Se for playing it safe, for continuing to roll out the old hits. Now, those are delicious hits. No, I mean,
sure.
someone may save up for months to go and have this amazing dinner at Per Se, and Pete Wells wasn't throwing the flag saying, hey, Keller, you're not doing delicious. He was saying, you're an artist and you're doing lazy.
Resting on your laurels.
Yeah.
I
like to be around people who are not pushing the envelope for innovation's sake, but they're challenging themselves to evolve and grow. Look at Jason Alley here in town.
Yeah.
He built this mini empire mm-hmm. on pasture and comfort, and he could have stopped there. Now he's getting into Oaxacan cuisine, and
right.
he's done
That's
barbecue
amazing.
And tacos.
That's
and
amazing.
These are outside of his maybe cornbread and collards upbringing. But he's like, dude, I'm into delicious. Let's try it. Let's bring people in. Let's go for it.
Yeah.
I want to hitch my fork to his wagon.
That interest, that curiosity never wanes. Yeah. It's not necessarily about the money or how many restaurants you can open, but
right.
it's how far you can go with mm-hmm. your own talents and things. Yeah, I love that. I love that. How did you get this gig? I'm asking for a friend.
I'm asking for a friend.
Because I was like, wow. I mean, you just emailed him and said, hey, I want to take you through Virginia?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's one of the great moments of my writing career. And I believe firmly in serendipity that these are you have to pay attention to those signs. Sometimes they're very subtle. And it was this simple.
Yeah.
Read a piece in the New York Times. Sent a high five text to the writer saying, hey, really dug your story. He writes back and says, you know what? I think you and Bo are simpatico. I'm like, well, can I reach out? He's like, sure. Gives me a Hotmail address, which to me is like the equivalent of the info at Black Hole.
Uh-huh.
And I just lobbed up this idea like, hey, read that story. If you're down for an adventure,
yeah,
hit me.
Yeah.
And I get a text back. What do you got in mind? And I said, I want to roll out some red carpet in the Blue Ridge and throw you into the soup of Virginia.
Yeah.
The first time I met him was at baggage claim at the airport. It was a handful of texts and emails.
Wow.
And we made first contact in October. And by mid-November, he was on my doorstep.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Totally sight unseen. I mean, this was an exercise in trust.
Sure.
And
sure.
flow. And
were you intimidated at all? Like, this big chef is coming and you're like, oh my God, I got to take him to these places and maybe he won't like it. And
okay, so confession, I didn't know how big he was until he was already here. And which is great, because had I read that, I think I would have come from a place of fear.
Yeah.
And instead, I'm like, you know what? I read this piece and he sounds awesome. And he sounds, mm-hmm. I saw him as a human being and we're the same age. And I felt like we were at a similar place in our life. And instead of meeting him and putting him on a pedestal, I put us both into the mix. Okay. In fact, I went right from the airport. This was my thinking. I have 5 children. I said, I have to have him trust me enough to open up. And the only way I can do that is to show him my life and let him see the love and joy that surrounds me and let him glean from that authenticity. So I go from the airport. Instead of taking him to a fancy restaurant, I take him to a friend's house with a backyard pizza oven. They have 4 kids. So now there's 9 children. And we just start slinging hash and making pizzas and pouring a wine out of little jelly jars.
Yeah.
And by the end of that night, we were brothers. And we've been brothers ever since.
So that's so cool.
We opened the door to each other. And that's why that piece reads that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, I know how to put sentences together. But what you read in that is the energy of 2 people on an adventure sharing many, many serendipities. It culminates with Pete Wells showing up at our pop-up, another mini miracle, the night that the restaurant that hosted us won Best Restaurant in New York, and we're having the dinner on the pass in the kitchen amidst all of this. And there's Joe Spurrata from Heritage sitting next to
him. Oh, he was there too.
Yeah.
And this was quite the dinner because it was, 1,500 invites and 6 guests?
Correct.
So 1,500 people sign up.
Right.
And 90 minutes prior, they inform 6 people that they can come.
Bo hands me his phone.
While
he's still, he didn't even have the menu written. This is 90 minutes before. Cool as can be. Just like a jazz performer saying, hey, here are the melodies. These are the riffs. These are the anchors. I know we have a Haman sweet potato. I know we have autumn olive pork. I know we have cheese from Caramont, oysters from Rappahannock. Every ingredient was from our hunting and gathering in Virginia.
You did really well with that because that's where I would have taken him to. I'm like, oh, he hit all the Miroir and you know, met Diane Flint, Foggy Ridge, and
had her
the Shack.
Absolutely.
And Gail at Caramount. I mean, she's amazing. Yeah. I love her. I just went to a dinner on her farm in the winter, 4 days after the election. Thank God she had that dinner. I was like,
healing,
this is so needed right now. And everybody was kind of...
She's the goat whisperer.
Yes, she is the goat whisperer. But that was a good tour, really good tour. And I was struck by how you had dinner on the pass, and when you were at the Shack, you were drinking cider in the kitchen right next to the fryer, so the oil was jumping on you out of cork containers, not out of flutes.
Right.
So there's that, what, precious fancy food, but done in a casual, like, let's just break bread over the grill type of way.
That's where I'm trying to go as a human being, and it's where I'm trying to take my writing.
Yeah.
There's certainly a lot of precious food writing that feels you're a voyeur. You're watching someone else have an experience.
Food porn.
Yeah, food porn. And instead, I say, let's create something aspirational where you can actually have this experience. Maybe it motivates someone to just go out back and pick fresh mint and put the intention in that mojito. And to me, intention is the important word here, because the intention behind growing, behind sourcing, behind plating, I think that is immediately apparent. And the difference between a Michelin 3-star and a 1-star, I went to back-to-back in Chicago, and I had a way better experience in the 1-star than I did the 3. Not because of the stars, but because the 3-star wanted to show me their ego. They wanted the show.
Totally.
And the 1-star nourished me and showed me her heart and her intention.
Yeah.
And I came away with an understanding of each dish, a memory, whereas the 3-star was a blitz of theater, of smoke, of polished meticulousness.
Yeah.
But it felt soulless. And for me, the intention, if the intention is to wow people and show, well, that's what they're going to come away with. I came away with, you know, my Instagram filled with wonder.
Yeah.
But that next night, the intent was to feed me, was to nourish me.
Mm-hmm.
And I came away wanting to have a relationship with the chef. And I ended up writing a Washington Post piece about that chef, because I walked out of that restaurant that night with a promise. I said, I am setting an intention right now that within the next 365 days, you and I will have an adventure together, and I will have an opportunity to share with my world who you are. And we did it.
That's fantastic. And to me, 3-star, like when you get to that level, it's so formal and stiff. It's almost like dining at your boss's house. Like you feel like you need to be on your best behavior.
Right.
You know, use the right napkin. Like it intimidates me a little bit. I'll do it and it's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I love the more soulful intention.
Right.
And I had something occur to me while you were talking. You said when you have intention for the ingredient and you take that little extra care with your mojito, it's almost like active self-care for yourself, because you can do passive self-care where you just turn on Netflix and order a pizza.
Mm-hmm.
But active self-care, maybe you go for a walk and then you go in your backyard and you cut that mint and you make yourself a nice drink.
Mm-hmm.
That little bit of effort.
Right.
Goes so much farther to feed yourself than just sitting back and going, okay, you know.
Look, it's not easy.
No, not at all. It takes effort.
It does. And the reward, here's what I'm learning about creating this lifestyle, right? I definitely have friends who make way more money than me, but I have very few that are having more fun. And it's because, you know, they talk about the 10,000 hours to achieve mastery. And if you want to be a violinist or a classically trained pianist, it's 10,000 hours. I feel like I've put 10,000 hours into leisure, into fun, and fanatical devotion to taking that extra moment to fix a proper bee's knees for my wife, even though there's the crazy and, oh my gosh, we've got to fix dinner. Because there ends up being this transference of energy through that.
Yeah.
And when someone has taken the intention, I'm thinking of Bill and India Cox at Castlemont Farm.
Sure.
When you have his asparagus, this is not like a meat and three on the side kind of thing. It's like the asparagus is the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And whether or not you're conscious, whether or not someone wants to, you know, throw the "you're being too metaphysical" flag on me, this is like a living organism, this asparagus, and it has been imbued not just with the water and the soil and the terroir, but Bill and India's intention behind that. And when it goes to my plate, I'm not just eating the cell membrane of that vegetable.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I'm getting a little bit of Bill and India in that. And maybe it's placebo effect, but whether or not it is, I feel an energetic boost from that. So nice. I try to do the same thing. Remember when your mama used to put a little note in your lunch?
Yeah.
Did it make your egg salad sandwich physically taste better? No, but it, you know what? It lifted you.
Sure,
so
sure.
So I try, and look, I'm not saying this happens all the time. There are plenty of days where it's like, kids, here's a frozen pizza. Mom and I are going to go out to Metzger and have a real meal. But when we break bread, which is 5 or 6 nights a week, it is intention put onto that table. We play high-low every night. What was a higher day? What was a lower your day?
Hmm.
I'm trying to teach the children to have intention. I don't want the silverware thrown on the table. Hmm. I want them lined up. I want the napkins folded.
Yeah.
And sometimes it is just a, like, boom, let's hustle.
Yeah.
But that intention creates a culture. It becomes incongruent to then not give a damn about other things in your life. If you, the way Christelle put this espresso,
that's lovely.
On my coast, right, with the lemon, and here's the citrus, and here, like, why not? Just take an extra second and make your life a little more beautiful.
Exactly. And the more you do it, it becomes a habit.
Right. And then you start to notice moments that it could be beautiful.
Yeah.
That's where you have an opportunity to introduce it to someone else.
I like that.
Our church recently was hosting homeless families for the week, and member families were asked to make a meal. And so we made a giant salad, and I brought a meat and cheese plate as well. And instead, like, you know, the kids, like, just wanted to take the big hunks of cheese and meat and just, like, put it on the piece of slate. And I'm like, let's make something pretty. Like, when's the last time they had cheese and charcuterie? Like, let's put it out and let's let them have the experience that we're grateful for.
Sure, sure.
Where it's been put out beautifully. And here's the little jam and the little... And there was that part of me went, oh my gosh, like, we don't want to come across as like, oh, we're granting you our fancy food. It wasn't like that. Instead, it was, we want you for a moment to be transported to a place where you are just noticing how pretty the plate is and how delicious the food is, instead of, oh my gosh, I need calories so we can survive another night.
Sure, sure. And you end up feeling cared for.
Yeah.
Like, it's that little extra step where it's feeding and more than just food. I love it. And I consider you a true Renaissance man, because you've got a lot of stuff going on, a lot of different interests. I love your website.
Thank you.
Like the video and the contents of your bag. I love that part. The Modern Gentleman. Mm-hmm. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, I needed to read it, frankly. I'm a cat from Jersey who grew up, my mother was a secretary and my father was a general contractor. And at 40, my mother quit all that and said, I'm going to become a doctor. And
no way. That's
at
awesome.
40.
Yeah.
Basically went back to prereqs.
That's amazing.
And started to learn. And by 50, she was a doctor. And now she's a widely nationally respected naturopath who's written 2 books and travels around the country healing people. And so early on, my mother was always looking ahead, and mm-hmm. she dated out of our social group. There were the high-rolling Jersey mobsters, you know, Jimmy the Eraser, you know, and cool cats who always had cash and a boutonniere and a pocket square and would throw down 20s. Now, I learned later on some of those were dubious. You know, there was Uncle Ray who married Aunt Georgia, Ray Corgia, and she became Georgia Corgia. That's true. And he was like, you know, a dirty cop and Patterson and a lot of colorful characters.
Yeah,
but they were well-dressed. They taught me that a gentleman could have a manicure and dance and still be rough and tumble. And the mashup of that with an East Coast and West Coast upbringing. I went to high school in Northern California. So I'm mixing like Bon Jovi and Depeche Mode and wearing guy liner and parachute pants. And like, you know, fast forward. I needed to codify that, and it was the late 90s. It was either wine school or law school for me. And at 25, I set another intention. By 30, I want to either have written a book or be a sommelier. Well, 26, I'm studying and I'm writing. 27 and a half, I'm really getting Italy down. It was the first region I knew cold. I'm experimenting with ascots and top hats and vintage clothes, and I'm wearing taps on my shoes to go clubbing and figuring that whole side out. And then it's 28 and three quarters, and I've got a book, but you need a literary agent, and now I'm trying to find that. And I'm running the wine program at one of the best Italian restaurants in Atlanta, Vinnie mm-hmm. Vidivici, to 29 and three quarters. It is my 30th birthday, and I'm a sommelier, but I've got a book and I've got a literary agent, but you need a publisher. I'm like, well, you know what? I'll be a som, and that'll be awesome. That day, on my 30th birthday, the manila envelope from Random House comes.
No
that day.
Kidding.
That day.
Serendipity.
And
again.
I'm like, you know what? Now I'm into both, and wine and words have been the foundation of my life ever since. 3 books.
Yeah.
2 national of wine writing awards.
Yeah, yeah.
And now this best food writing, wine led me to food, led me to travel, to culture, to
sure,
style.
Sure.
And The Modern Gentleman, A Guide to Essential Manners, Savvy, and Vice, was a way for me to write the instruction manual that I never got, being A, an only child, and B, not having strong male figures in my life. I was raised by a pack of wild women and in a matriarchal family with really strong women. I'm yeah. still surrounded by strong women, but there were few men who laid the pillars of what it meant to be a gentleman for me. So I did the research and wrote it down. And now my boys, I've got three boys and two girls, will have hopefully an instruction manual.
See, and my nephew's graduating high school in June. He's getting a copy. That's going to be one of his gifts. Because nice. He's very, what's the word? Sartorial. He dresses for school. Mm-hmm. And it's Great. Impressive. I saw him. And I was like, wow, did you have a job interview today? He's like, no, Nene, I wear
no,
this
I
to
just
school.
Care, right?
Yeah, he makes that effort. He makes that little extra effort. Mm-hmm. I'm curious because I've never written about wine because I'm wine ignorant. I know what I like and I know what I enjoy. Is it different when you write about wine as opposed to food? Do you adopt a different tone or do you have a different intention when you sit
sure.
down?
I had a breakthrough in the past year or two of, when it comes to wine writing. For a long time, going back to the early 2000s, right? Modern Gentleman comes out in 2002. My first wine piece was around 2001, 1999, right in there. And at that point, as a psalm, I tended to lead with the technical. Oh, I wanted to talk about the acid and the tannin. And then as I became more confident in my skills, I wanted to share more what was behind the wine. And in the last year or two, I've made a complete shift. Instead of talking about the way a wine tastes or smells, mm-hmm. I've been talking about wine in terms of how it feels. And this is because much of my career, while is on the page, I spend a lot of time performing. I'm on the stage. I go and I write about something, and then I go and I share it. Mm-hmm. I call it compose, choreograph, connect. The compose part, I go and discover. The choreograph is creating an event around that content and then connecting, bringing people in to meet the growers, the producers. When I'm on the stage and I'm talking about wine and I ask someone, hey, what does it taste like? They're nebulous and they're insecure about what they taste or smell. Yet, if I ask someone how something feels, their emotion is cogent, it's compelling, they're confident in that. Mm-hmm. I said, you know what? That's the way we need to approach food and drink. And it's not just for wine, but especially for wine. Instead of using highfalutin, inaccessible language and saying, it's helpful to describe a Sauvignon Blanc as smelling like cat pee, but it's not really an emotional connection. Instead, if I say, wow, this wine is zippy and energetic and it makes me want to throw bocce balls and I'm outside, like there's an energy there. If I say that Madeira is contemplative and I want to gather like a couple of close friends in a heavy sweater and hang by the fire and tell stories of Spain and Portugal, like that conveys a different energy. And I feel like that's more accessible. And this, I've got a big piece coming out in Esquire this spring, and it's the first time at a national level I went all in and said, I'm not going to use flavor and sensory descriptors as much as I'm going to use emotional ones. And my editors came back. This was one of those cases where, you know, my kids will take a test and I say, how'd you do? They say, oh my gosh, I think I failed. And then they get an A and I can't understand and go, how is that possible? Like when I've done good work, I know it. When I handed it in, I went, oh my gosh, they're going to kick my ass. They're going to come back and say, you know, what is this?
Yeah.
And instead they came back and the light was on. Like, we get it.
Not
Let's
good.
Do this.
And
I hope it leads to a shift in the way that we talk about food and wine, because ultimately it's not just a bunch of salt and acid mixed up together. It's soul. Mm-hmm. It's place. It's, again, that we keep coming back to intention. I feel like that's the leitmotif of this whole conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's important to say that my Caesar salad had anchovy and felt like this, and we communicate something about how it felt in the mouth.
Yeah.
But if I can talk about the of the pepper and the table side toss of the wooden spoon and the squeeze of the lemons and the of the egg, like that takes me to a place differently than there was an extra tablespoon of oil.
Right, right. That's fantastic. Like feelings as when describing wine. And I'm wondering if all wine writers are writers or if they're just ticking off boxes, like what they taste. You as a writer, as a fully formed, excellent food writer, I would want to read your descriptions of wine because they're going to take me to that place and they're going to give me that connection that maybe somebody more technical wouldn't. And I could see this for beer, like you could, or food, obviously, but but especially beer, wine, cocktails, things like that. Well, maybe not. Well, spirits, where it becomes more of a checking of boxes, like, well, it tastes crisp, it tastes this, it tastes that. I love that.
Well, I get that there's a time for critical analysis, right? I'm a sommelier, but I'm not a master sommelier, and to me, it's the difference between PhD and GED. But I know enough that when I'm interacting with the consumer, I want to bring them into my joy and not just wave above them my learnedness. And too often I see the experts lording over saying, well, you can't understand, you know, it's fruit, but it's black fruit, but it's slightly underripe in black fruit. Like, cool for you that you've reached a place where you can tell the difference between the pith of the grapefruit, whether it's white or yellow. Awesome.
Yeah.
But wouldn't it be even cooler to take someone who's only been drinking Coca-Cola and White Zinfandel and let them experience your exuberance? And instead of saying, well, you're not ready for this, be like, I've got, you know what, let's drink some Lambrusco.
Yeah.
Oh, let's have something like, let's meet them where they are.
Yeah.
Nobody grew up drinking Campari. I say this knowing my 10-year-old, the first time she tasted, actually liked it. We
wow, that's impressive.
Evolved our palates to a place where a Negroni is something that makes our mouths water.
Yeah.
But that's not where we began. I can remember drinking bottles and James wine coolers, right? And and I remember the excitement of having them, right? So instead, we connect to that emotion and say, let's bring people to the excitement so that when they do have that Barbaresco, my license plate says Nebbiolo, by the way, NBBIOLO. That's how much I love that grape. When they reach that, and instead of us keeping it from them, we say, we invite them to that experience. And the only way to do that is to meet them where they are and not say, oh, look where I am.
Exactly. Yeah, not lording it over them, saying, well, my palate is so precious, I haven't insured, and, you know, I can do this. What's it like to work with Luca? I've met him briefly. Mm-hmm. I would love to speak with him.
Mm. I think he is one of the greatest human beings I've ever known. He's been a mentor. I love him as a father. He's taught me. He has 3 children, and I watch the way he is with his sons and daughter. I love him as a winemaker, his minimalist touch, his value for elegance and grip.
Yeah.
The way he is with his unoaked whites.
Yeah.
I love that he's taught me about texture, about aromatics, his courage to pull a vintage in an off year to say we're not going to bottle our best cuvée. We are even in a difficult year where there's been frost, where there's already limited fruit, he still goes and does a green harvest because he wants the wine to be excellent and not just prodigious. The way that he's created an estate in Virginia that feels European in its aesthetic, tradition, and heritage. To me, the only thing that trumps Southern hospitality is Italian hospitality. And that's only because they've been at it for like 1,000 years longer. And Barbersville Vineyards is a place that I hope to have a relationship with for the rest of my life. I've been with Luca in some capacity. It'll be 15 years this June.
That long?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
And a quick side story about how I ended up there. Talk about serendipity. I married a Virginian, so you have to make that requisite trip to Monticello, right?
Of course.
And coming from Jersey, it was all about George Washington. Oh, hey, crossing into Delaware and Christmas. And Jefferson's on like the $2 bill. Who is this guy? And there I am at Monticello overlooking the Commonwealth. And it was 4th of July weekend. So they're telling the story, you know, how he dies on Independence. Is it the 4th yet? And he dies 50 years to the day of signing the Declaration. And I was just so filled with patriotism and like Virginiana. I wanted to go home.
Oh, I like that Virginia.
I wanted to go home with something with a little bit more import than like a shaky snow globe with UVA in it, right? And I go into Charlottesville and my kind of souvenir is wine. I go into the wine shop and there's this wall of Virginia wine. This is 2001.
Yeah.
I had never, I mean, they said, oh, Virginia grows wine, turn the page. I'd never seen or tasted a Virginia wine, and there were black dogs and unicorns and butterflies, and I saw this serious-looking wine, Barbersville Vineyards Sangiovese 1998, made by Luca Paschina. I'm like, hey, it's got an Italian on the bottle. How bad could it be? I take it back to Atlanta, where I was running the show at this Italian restaurant, open the bottle, and I was thunderstruck. First thing I thought was they're buying fruit from out of state. And I fax my credentials, shows how long ago this was. I fax my credentials to Luca and I say, I want to tell this story. And I quit my job and moved to Virginia 2 months later.
That's amazing.
And my somethings thought God. I was out of my flipping mind.
Yeah. You know, what are you
like,
doing?
They're like, dude, you love Sangiovese. Like, go to Italy. You know, don't be an idiot. But the master somms who taught us always said, trust your palate. Trust your palate. I'm like, my palate's telling me that some, I mean, how often in our lifetime will we have a wine region spring up right under our noses? And so I hightailed it to Virginia. And in those early days, The Modern Gentleman came out in 2002. I started with Luca in June 2002, not knowing how that book would become this bestseller in its category. So I started hitting the streets for Barbersville. And what I did is I would get all dressed up. We're talking suit, tie bar, hat, because I wanted people to treat these wines with respect. And I would go, and like blind tasting, I would knock on the doors of the best restaurants and retail shops. And this was the early day of cell phones. And I'd call and I'd make an appointment. And they'd say, where are you from again? I'm like, I'm going to show up with Cabernet and Viognier and Brown Bagot. And then they would taste. And I'd do the reveal. And they'd be like, are you been kidding me? And some of my earliest wins were Marcel's in D.C. Where Moez is one of the best Somms on the East Coast.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, selling to... the Inn at Little Washington, going to places where I knew they were tasting for flavor and intention and not ratings and marketing and status. Exactly. Yeah.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. What are some of your favorites at Barbersville? Like I know the Nebbiolo, of course.
Right. Oh, Nebbiolo is my desert
Nebbiolo.
Island dream. Nebbiolo.
I took Italian. I should know that. Well, Nebbiolo.
One thing I love about Barbersville is that its portfolio at large is solid. I would like to give a shout to some of the other Virginia wineries.
Oh,
I think it's important that people know that Virginia is not a one-horse town when it comes to wine. I greatly admire Linden. We call it the Jim Law of the land. The way he has poured respect into that soil, and that's what he gets out of it. I admire the wines from RDV. I think Chrysalis and their Albarino, one of the most surprising wines for me of this year is their Old Norton.
I just talked to Todd Kleiman.
Ah, great. Yeah, he
last
wrote a book
week.
On it. Sure.
Yeah, fantastic book.
Veritas, King Family, Glen Manor, Michael Schaps makes the best Petite Mansang in the state. So it used to be I'd rattle off two or three names and I'd start to run out. And these days, I feel like I can hit a dozen and fill a case with wines that to anyone who digs wine, not just like, oh, I like oddities, not just, show me something local, but wines that can hang at a national and world-class level, and we've got them.
Yeah, absolutely. All good stuff. All good stuff. Oh, my God, this has been such a great talk. I'm trying to think. I don't want to keep you, but I want to make sure I hit everything, too. Let's see. We talked about Bobek. We talked about wine. We talked about the Modern Gentleman. What do you see for your future? What projects do you have going on right now?
Excellent.
What do you still? I feel like there's a lot still there, a lot of intention still there.
Well, I know there's another book in me that I want to get rolling on it, and my publisher has been asking for The Modern Father for a long time, and I said as soon as I have teenagers. Well, I now have a teenage daughter and a teenage son. And it's time to get rolling on that. I'm about to move into a house that my family and I have been building. A skinny house, right.
That's
very
cool.
Skinny house in Church Hill in Richmond. I've always said if you're going to live in a small city, live in the city.
Yes.
Right? So in this mini metropolis,
yes,
we found a skinny lot. It's 16 feet wide. And the house is 15 feet wide on the inside, but it's 78 feet long. It's like a Powhatan longhouse.
Yeah.
And we will move in the next 30 to 40 days. And when I go in that office, my mom came through the naturopath and burned sage, got the smudge stick out and blessed the house like in its bones when it was framed. And I set that intention in that office. I'm like, this is where I'm going to write the next one. And so I've gotten started. Will I get finished in 2017? Who can say? The other intention that I've set for this year is I want to have another submission for Best Food Writing. And I had my first Pulitzer nomination in 2016.
You did? That's incredible. How did I miss that in my research?
It was about poetry, actually. Something.
Oh, my God.
Different.
So not even food.
Getting a taste of that level was something that's inspired me to like keep going.
Congratulations.
Thank you. That was about research and going deep. It was fascinating, and that's where I'd like to be. I want to continue to have adventures and discover and to push myself as a human being, as a father, as a husband, and as an artist.
God, that's amazing. And I love all the development in Church Hill right now. I'm from Richmond, so I grew up on Northside. So seeing that neighborhood come back
with
Sub Rosa and Proper Pie and WPA, I'm like, thank God. It's so cute. This has been fantastic. Can we end with a few fun, like, speed round
questions? Oh, yeah, let's do it. Lightning bonus round.
Yeah, lightning bonus round.
Hand on my buzzer.
All right, you're on a road trip, and you stop at a convenience store, and you've got $5. What do you buy?
Ooh, I love bubbly water in the car. I also learned the value of a road beer. I'm not condoning drinking.
Like a shower beer,
being
but
intoxicated.
On the road.
Yeah, there's a big difference between drunk driving and traveling with a beer.
Yeah.
So.
All right, and this is a selfish question. What's your favorite cigar?
Ooh, my pick.
I'm buying a gift, so I want to know from a guy that knows.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Padron and Olivas Nubs when I only have a little bit of time because they're only like 3 inches long. They do a beautiful short perfecto.
Okay.
And you know, now that Cuba is going to come back online in the States, but for the longest time, all those families moved to Nicaragua and the Dominican Republic. So those are good places to look. Absolutely.
Okay, cool. Mm-hmm. Cool. And, oh Lord, I'm having another brain fart, Janae. This isn't good. What's the last really great thing you ate?
Last really great. Well, I'm actually on a cleanse right now. This is day six.
Oh, no.
Day six of a cleanse.
And so cayenne pepper and lemon.
not far from, but I made part of the cleanse. I can do as many raw vegetables as I like, and then I can cook them simply. And I made a lentil soup, and I put cayenne pepper on that. But it was like the slow cook of the garlic and onion. And you know, when you're not eating a lot of food, like all of a sudden just the smell of the garlic and onion got like I was in my grandmother's kitchen again.
Yeah.
And I wasn't able to eat the bread that my children were having. Like this was my one bowl of soup. And I was so excited to have something hot after doing like shakes and things.
Right.
I'm just trying to get my system clean after.
Sure.
I've had a lot of all the inputs and they've all been delicious. But that bowl of soup with like four ingredients, I had two big helpings of it, and I felt fed.
Very cool. Very cool. And the last question I always ask to kind of pay it forward, who in our food community in this region should I speak with next?
Who should you speak with next? I think that Brittany Anderson at Metzger Bar and Butchery is doing some of the most exciting work in our city. You know, Jason Alley, we already mentioned him, gets a lot of play.
Yeah.
There's a reason. He is a good person with a big heart.
He's amazing.
Doing great work.
We're friends. I'm still bitter about Charlottesville.
I can understand.
I speak about it on the podcast fairly often. I'm like, are you kidding me? Like,
I think Kendra Feathers.
Kendra.
She's done building this empire as a strong woman.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of the women in our town are just behind the scenes. They may not be the ones cooking, but they're the ones running the restaurants and the restaurant groups. And I'd like to see them get more attention and not just the chefs. It's like the winemakers get the attention, but it's actually the grape growers who are really the ones making the wine. The winemakers are the shepherds putting it into bottle. So all those GMs, all the accountants, those are the ones that are making sure that places like the Roosevelt and Pasture Run and Kendra and Michelle Jones, and let's not forget Julia Battellini, one of the badass mamas of our town, one of the strongest palates. She is who I go to. Actually, I'm going to be celebrating my anniversary tonight. I'm going to break my cleanse to have some bubbly at Secco, and Julia will do me right.
Oh, it's Secco Wine Bar. I love that place. Mm-hmm. Oh, good. Good recommendations. Thank you. And
thanks for having me, Janae.
Yeah, thanks for talking. This was terrific.
Yay.
Yeah, like I said, after I talked with Jason, I left the building and it was a beautiful sunny day. It was very warm that day. And I did mosey around Jackson Ward for a little bit with my pack on my back, reminiscing, feeling nostalgic. It made me I'm turning 50 next month. I know. That's probably a big reason. It made me want to be back in my 20s, hustling, struggling. And, I hustle and struggle now, but in a different way, with a different mindset. I became nostalgic for Richmond. I miss Richmond. There's a vibe and a funkiness and a artsiness and a crunchiness there that's here in Charlottesville, too. It's probably because I grew up there, but what a great talk, right? I left with that notion of setting your intention, being self-aware, living awake, not just moving through your day blind and deaf and asleep. And I came home the very next day and wrote a blog about a memory that I had with my friend. And I used the theme of intention to end the blog. And it got more reaction from readers than I have had in probably a year. In a year. And so, Jason, thank you. Thank you for putting that nugget in my brain, for paying that forward, for spreading the love, for giving me that idea, because it has stayed with me. And I hope it grows. I hope, like a seed, it grows. And I hope by us mentioning it, and by Jason mentioning it and me talking about it now, that maybe it will help you as well. It will help you to set your intention. Even if you forget, if you do it once, maybe you'll remember it 3 weeks from now and you'll do it again, and eventually it'll become a habit. And another thing you could have as a habit, how about that for a segue? Read some food writing. Make that a habit. Food writing is important no matter the genre you enjoy when you read, whether it's politics, history, comedy, memoir, fiction, culture, all of it you can find in food writing. Come out Sunday the 26th to see Jason on the panel, Best American Food Writing, at the JMRL on Market Street, 1 to 2:30. Hell, go to all the food events. There's probably 8 or 10 of them happening in town the 22nd through the 26th. I'll have the links in the show notes. And thank you so much for being here today. Quick shout out from Teej.fm, patreon.com/audaciouspod if you'd like to learn more about sponsoring this podcast. If you'd like a premium sponsorship, I've got a press kit for you. And I hope that you have enjoyed this four-part series on food writing. Have you enjoyed it? Did you think it was boring and you hated it? Let me know. Tweet me at audaciouspod. Send me an email, contact@audacious.co. I want to hear from you. I always want to hear from you, good or bad, because hearing from you is better than not hearing from you. I do not do this in a void. This is a community podcast. Let's build it together, shall we? And until next time, 2 weeks from now, I'm going to take a little break. So in 2 weeks, I will see you again. I am Janae Libby of Audacious Food Talk for Gluttons. I'm ferocious, very loquacious. Today, I'm feeling very gracious. And when it comes to learning about food and keeping those connections going, I'm audacious, and I hope you are too. Big love, guys. Big love.